This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. This year, for the first time, the Autism Society of America called April Autism Acceptance Month instead of Autism Awareness Month, and they're not the only organization to make the change. The move represents a long fight for autism advocates to create a more inclusive future that celebrates neurodiversity. The push aims to support autistic people instead of working to find a cure or changing who they are. Autism is often misunderstood by people who aren't autistic. What are some of the common misconceptions about the disability? And should we reevaluate how we think about autism? Here to guide us through it all is Sarah Luderman, an independent journalist covering disability policy, politics, and culture. She's autistic. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Eric Garcia. He's a journalist and author of the forthcoming book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. He's also autistic. Eric, welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Steve Silberman, author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And Steve is neurotypical. Steve, we appreciate your time today.
I am honored to be here.
Sarah, let's get everyone on the same page. When we talk about autism, what are we talking about? How do you explain or describe the disability?
Well, autism is a little bit hard to define because it turns out genetically there's probably a lot of different things that we're calling autism. It's typically defined by three core features: repetitive behaviors, social differences in interaction, and differences in communication. But I think that also there's a lot more going on there. A lot of people, when you think about autism, you think about like sort of two really specific kinds of person. You either think about like Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang Theory, where like the person's like a super genius and like knows everything about Star Trek, or you think about someone who has an intellectual disability and is like a monstrous affliction upon their parents. And neither of those are real people. The truth is a lot more complicated and involves a lot more different gradations and a lot more variety and challenges. I do think it's important to like emphasize that autism is a disability. I think some people misunderstand neurodiversity to mean that it's like a 24/7 bouncy house party where nobody ever has any problems. Mm-hmm. But I think that really like the point of neurodiversity is that we are like everybody deserves basic human rights, regardless of whatever their skills are or whatever their impairments are or whatever kind of brain they have. Mm-hmm. We're all valuable people.
Steve, we often hear autism described as a spectrum. Can you expand that for us a bit? What do we mean by that?
Yeah, sure. One of the reasons why people think that there are somehow more autistic people now than there were years ago is because 30 years ago, autism was defined very, very narrowly. In fact, so narrowly that many of the people who get the diagnosis now would have been considered eligible for the diagnosis. And not only that, but autism was formerly considered a childhood disorder. Autistic people became adults, they sort of became invisible to the psychiatric establishment. So really what the spectrum is a recognition that there is a very, very wide range of gifts and challenges within autism, ranged from someone who is able to speak, but who can type their thoughts on a keyboard, to someone who is profoundly intellectually disabled, to someone who could be working as a chief engineer of a very successful Silicon Valley company. Obviously, that's a huge range of behaviors, abilities, and challenges. And that's one of the reasons why autism ends up being so controversial, because people fight over, you know, what is the true extent of autism? Mm-hmm.
Well, Margot from Maryland emailed, I am autistic and non-conversational. I communicate by typing very slowly. I'm 11 years old. I write to ask for respect for autistic individuals. Please know we hear everything, even if we don't look like it. Margot, thanks for reaching out. Eric, there's been a push by some advocates to move from autism awareness to autism acceptance. What does acceptance mean to you?
Sure. That's a great question. I agree with Sarah's take that I think autism acceptance, a lot of people misunderstand it to think that we think that it means that autism is all great or it's all wonderful. No, it's acknowledging that autism is a disability and acknowledging that autistic people deserve acceptance for who they are as human beings and deserve all the rights as other human beings. And to Marco's point, what I want to say is that you deserve to be respected. And yes, people deserve to be treated as if they understand everything that you are saying and doing to them. I think one of the tragedies is that a lot of times we talk about autism without consulting what autistic people are thinking. And we often assume that they can't hear what they're saying. But obviously, Marco is 11 and is typing out these things. He clearly understands what they're saying, and you should always assume that autistic people, A, should have a say in how in any policy or decision that governs their lives, and B, that you should always, even if they aren't at the table, that you should assume that they know what you're talking about.
And I just want to be clear that that message came from Margot. I'll make sure we get the name right there. Well, here's a voicemail we got from one of you who wanted to share your thoughts on this move from awareness to acceptance.
Hi, this is Carol Greenberg. I'm the autistic mother of a mostly non-speaking, high-support autistic teenage son. The journey from autism awareness to autism acceptance is actually fairly clear to autistic people. Autism awareness is mostly promoted by non-autistics. It's about what we are to non-autistic people. Are we a drain? Are we a burden to society, a tragedy to our families? Whereas autism acceptance centers us in the conversation. It's about our goals, our voices, communicating however works best for us, and our experiences. It leads to an interdependent relationship with our communities in the future. And that's really what we want.
Carol, thanks for that message. Sarah, we just heard from Carol about her ideas. How do you think of autism acceptance?
So the conversation about autism awareness versus autism acceptance has actually been going on within the autism and autistic community for a number of years at this point. I personally am not I think that there's a lot of overemphasis on specific words and language. Julia Bascom, who's the executive director of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which is the main organization by and for autistic adults in the United States, says, social justice is not a magic spell. You don't say the right words and then justice happens. So I really appreciate the shift from awareness to acceptance, but also, like, I think that a lot of the actions still need to catch up. Like, for example, I've seen a lot of things that were in April were marketed as autism acceptance, but then it was pretty much the same stuff that they were doing before, just with different words. And some of that stuff is kind of harmful.
We'll be back with more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Amazon Prime Video with The Underground Railroad. From Academy Award winner Barry Jenkins and based on the Pulitzer Prize winning novel by Colson Whitehead, the new Amazon original The Underground Railroad chronicles Cora Randall, played by newcomer Tuso Mbedu, when she discovers an actual network of trains and tunnels beneath the southern soil. Cora must evade a violent bounty hunter before she can find freedom. The Underground Railroad premieres May 14th on Amazon Prime Video.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Wyzant, a one-to-one tutoring alternative to online classes where you can learn face-to-face online. Get help with tackling new subjects and career skills, or just catching up. Wyzant lists thousands of personal instructors in over 300 subjects available for live, individualized lessons with their online learning platform. Head to WYZANT.com to find your perfect instructor. Love it or your first hour is free. Because at Wyzant, we take learning personally.
A few years ago, a website popped up in Stockton, California, and conspiracy theories started ramping way up.
And it's being funded by conservative movement underneath the table.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, people really believe this.
What happens when the local news outlet isn't fact-checking conspiracy theories? Maybe encouraging them. Listen now from NPR's Invisibilia podcast.
Let's jump back into our conversation about autism acceptance and the neurodiversity movement. Steve, not that long ago, autism organizations were focused on finding a quote-unquote cure for autism. The nonprofit Cure Autism Now was founded in 1995, and in 2016, Autism Speaks took CURE out of its mission statement. Explain the move away from the idea of finding a cure.
Well, we're recognizing that autistic people are just a variety of human beings, and like any human being, autistic people need help and accommodations with the things that they struggle with or find difficult, and support for when they excel and when they really get into something that they're doing. And so I basically feel like one of the things that's happened with the shift to acceptance is that we're just recognizing that autistic people are part of the spectrum of humanity. It's not a disease that needs to be cured. And organizations like Autism Speaks and Cure Autism Now, which eventually merged because their missions were virtually identical, were started by parents who had been persuaded that their children were made autistic by vaccines. That turned out to be a lie and a hoax. We now know that that's absolutely not true, but the effects of that disinformation campaign are still playing out now with COVID-19. And so basically, organizations like Autism Speaks that had a tremendous amount of money and did not really care about involving autistic people in their decision making because they thought of autistic people as either children or patients. Now what's happening is that autistic people are taking the lead in the conversation, and people like Eric Garcia, who I'm very honored to be on this panel with, are writing books that present the journey of autistic people through the eyes of the people who are living that experience. Now we're sort of understanding that autism is no more to be cured than, say, homosexuality. I'm gay, and when I was in high school, homosexuality was considered a mental disorder. It was listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and it was also considered a crime. Now I'm happily married. That's a tremendous amount of social change, and it had a lot to do with the fact that homosexuality was no longer considered a disease, and that's because gay therapists and gay people came out en masse, and now we recognize that being gay is just a flavor of humanity.
Well, we reached out to Autism Speaks for a statement, and here's what they said on the subject of a cure. Quote, since Autism Speaks was founded in 2005, research funded by our organizations and others has shown that there is no single autism. Science also tells us there will be no single cure. Today, Autism Speaks is not looking for a cure, and in fact, in 2016, the word cure was removed from our mission statement. We're talking about autism awareness and what it looks like with Sarah Luderman. She covers disability policy, politics, and culture. Also with us, Eric Garcia, a journalist and author of the forthcoming book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. And Steve Silberman, author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. We also want to hear from you. How do you feel about the shift toward autism acceptance? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. We got this email from Kelly in Minnesota who says, I discovered the neurodiversity movement online a couple of years ago, and it's improved my life and my outlook in a lot of ways. Even when I work really hard to meet neurotypical people's expectations of me, they don't always understand what I need or where I'm coming from. But neurodiversity frees me from trying so hard to meet these expectations. Steve, what is neurodiversity?
neurodiversity is, it's not an opinion, it's not a political stance, it's not an ideology. It's the recognition that human beings have different types of minds, each with distinctive sets of gifts and challenges. And by working together, those different kinds of minds can create the most creative possible kind of society. So neurodiversity is no more an idea than biodiversity is in a rainforest. And biodiversity in a rainforest is the fact that different species with different gifts and challenges can provide resilience in the face of changing conditions. And as humanity enters the 21st century, we've already seen some of the huge challenges that we're going to be facing, and we're going to need to be working with people with different kinds of minds to see those problems in all of their aspects and provide creative solutions.
And Eric, how do you see the concept of neurodiversity being talked about and utilized within the autistic community?
I see neurodiversity. This is important. I think that neurodiversity is a term that basically essentially says that we're human beings and we have rights, and that we are not failed versions of neurotypical, that we are fine just as we are. Do autistic people have impairments? Yes. Is it a disability? Yes. But it's saying that we are not, to borrow from my phrase from my book, we're not broken individuals. We're not failed individuals. We are human beings, and we deserve acceptance, and we deserve to be integrated into society, and we deserve to be treated fairly as human beings and as fully human, not as partially human, or not undeserving of fewer rights. And I think that even if neurodiversity in and of itself is no less political than biodiversity, because of the way that autistic people in particular have been treated, it in some ways becomes political, because a lot of the things that we want and the things that would help autistic people, that would, I guess you could say, neurodiversity-friendly policies require a political stance, and it requires people seeing disability as a political identity almost.
Well, we've been using the term autistic person instead of person with autism, and this is a preference you and Sarah share. Why do you have that preference, Eric?
I prefer that preference because I understand why a lot of parents. I want to say that I'm very sympathetic to a lot of parents. My mom is a phenomenal parent. I think a lot of parents say person with autism because they don't want autism to define them, and they're worried about the social stigma that comes with autism. I say autistic person in the same way that I say that I am Latino, or that I say that I'm a Latino person or a Latino American. You can't separate my autism from my humanity. It's a defining part of how I see the world and how I see society and how I relate to the world. I think about how I relate to the world. It affects me every day. When I go to the grocery store, I have to think about, is the lighting too bright? When I go to a concert, I have to think about, okay, is the music going to be too loud? When I'm on the train, I have to think about, and there's a long love affair of autistic between autistic people and trains. When I think about, going on the metro, I have to think about, is it too crowded or will I have a sensory meltdown? So but at the same respect, in the same token, I don't think I would be able to be a journalist and cover politics to the degree that I do, if it weren't for my capacity to have this almost photographic memory. So the reason why I refer to myself as autistic is that I understand why parents are worried about stigma and want to just say person with autism. But if all of these things are things I have to consider day in and day out, and at the same time, it helps me do my job really well. I don't think I would be the same journalist I would be, or I'd be the same person. I don't think I'd be the same son to my mother, or the same brother to my sister, or the same partner or friend to, hopefully after this, Sarah and Steve still consider me friends. So I think that it's important to say that when you say autistic, it's a trait, it's another seasoning in this gumbo that is Eric Garcia. So that's why I think it's important. You know, it affects how I interact with the world and how the world interacts with me.
In a moment, we'll look at self-advocacy and who speaks for autistic people. More from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Womply. Womply is committed to helping self-employed workers and small businesses get their PPP loan. They've helped over 100,000 small businesses. Even if you're a freelancer or gig worker, you may qualify. Womply makes the process easy. Start your application at womply.com/NPR, and they'll route it to an approved lender. Apply for free today at womply.com/NPR and see if you qualify.
Hi, it's Jen White. From politics to pop culture, 1A is the place for the national conversation on NPR. And our upgraded 1A Vox Pop app is the fastest and easiest way to add your voice. You'll see the latest and get a jump on upcoming stories all at the press of a button. Download the new 1A Vox Pop app for iOS and Android today and make yourself heard loud and clear on 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
Now let's get back to our conversation about autism acceptance and the neurodiversity movement. And we heard from a lot of you on the shift towards acceptance.
This is actually very much in keeping with my hopes, dreams, and activism as senior editor of Thinking Person's Guide to Autism, because this is what organizations like ours and the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network have been working on for years.
I think in the last few decades, we've all become aware. And according to my 18-year-old daughter, she would prefer being understood and accepted. And with that comes the understanding that the word cure kind of triggers some people in that community feeling that they're broken and need to be fixed.
I despise the missing puzzle piece motif. My son has all his puzzle pieces. They just fit together differently. He doesn't need to be cured. He needs to be accepted and taught to harness his strengths and work on his weaknesses just like every other child.
Shannon, Susan, Kat, thanks for sharing your thoughts. Well, let's listen to a voicemail. Here's Stephanie from Indiana.
I feel like for the most part, we have achieved autism awareness. But understanding and acceptance are a different matter entirely and seem to be more of the challenge that we now face. Autism is a spectrum disorder, so there are many folks who do not want or need a cure. But there are individuals like my niece who are incontinent, cannot speak, have to be fed. I would do anything for her to have a cure and live the life of her choosing and not the life that her autism dictates.
We also got this email from Becca who says, when people say they want prevention or a cure, what I hear is people like you shouldn't exist. You should never have been born. You're not good enough as you are. Sarah, how do you respond to people like Stephanie who would welcome a cure for her niece?
So I really want to push back against the idea that there are people like me who are generally perceived as like high functioning. I'm making quotation marks with my fingers that you can't see because we're on the radio. But and people like her niece. Her niece is not a broken person. I think that there's a broad spectrum of ability and disability and impairment in autism, and every single person on that spectrum is a valuable human being. I think that it's important to focus on helping her niece live the absolute best and most fulfilling life that she can. I think that it's important to have access to things like education, employment opportunities, friendship. And I also think that a lot of the physical stuff that she mentioned, like incontinence, are really scary to non-disabled people. When I think about autism, I especially like to think about it in the context of other disabilities. there are a lot of people who are incontinent or who don't speak using their mouths or who have intellectual disabilities, and every single one of them is capable of living a good life. You don't need to be non-disabled to live a good life. I think, like, I understand why she feels like a cure is necessary, and I understand that it seems like a more difficult case than, say, someone who is able to pass as normal more easily, but it's really important to stress that autism acceptance and neurodiversity are for everybody, not just some people.
And Steve, this is some of the criticism that we've seen coming into this conversation comes from parents or families who say, you know, neurodiversity, that movement is only for those who have low support needs, like autistic people who can live independently. Can you expand a little bit more on that tension?
Yeah, sure. I personally do not use the phrases high functioning and low functioning, because as an autistic person once said to me, if you're described as high functioning, your struggles are invisible. And if you're described as low functioning, your gifts and aptitudes become invisible. So I think, you know, language like high support needs and low support needs is better because it doesn't locate the flaw or deficit in the person. It locates the potential problems and challenges in the relationship between the person and their environment or the person and their society. And, you know, my mother has dementia and has problems with continence, and she's still my mother, and she can still live a wonderful life if we don't see her through condemning eyes and see her only as defined by the things that she struggles with. And so I feel like part of the problem is that there's been a false binary set up between the notion that autism is part of the human condition and neurodiversity. In other words, people often make the claim, and this is completely false, that neurodiversity advocates do not believe that autism is a disability. In fact, it's neurodiversity advocates who have been most vocally championing the idea that autism is a disability and that as a society, we should accommodate it like a disability in the same way that ideally we make public buildings accessible and put wheelchair ramps around places where people need to go, instead of saying someday everyone will be able to walk and people who can't walk are low functioning. So I feel like part of what's really important about understanding neurodiversity is that it foregrounds the notion that autism is a disability that deserves support and accommodations. It's not some kind of, it's not like a bouncy house of denying all of the problems that can happen when an autistic person's needs are not met by their environment.
Eric, the shift towards acceptance and neurodiversity seems to be happening in tandem with self-advocacy. Explain what self-advocacy means within the autistic community.
Certainly, and I should predicate that this is only from what I've seen, and I can't claim to speak for all other autistic people. But at its base level, I think you can't have neurodiversity without self-advocacy. And if anything, self-advocates have pushed for it. So at its core, self-advocacy means that autistic people should be the ones whose voices are centered in any discussion about autism, and that that autistic people are the best authority for their own to determine what's best for their own lives and their futures. That isn't to say that parents don't have a say or loved ones don't have a say, but that they're auxiliary, and that they should be pushing to amplify the voices of autistic people as well. So I think that at its core, self-advocacy basically means, going back to the old disability rights phrase, nothing about us without us. In the same core, I think, in the same spirit, I think it means that autistic people should be the main authorities on the subject of autism.
When we talk about the spectrum, there are also people who are non-talking or who require more resources than others, and parents or other family members may act as their voice or protector. Where does self-advocacy fit in those circumstances?
Certainly, and that's a really good question. You quoted Carol Greenberg and Shannon Desroches Rosa, and I think that both of them are, Carol is autistic as well, but I think that both of them do a fantastic job of using their voices as either low support need autistic people or neurotypical to amplify the needs of their autistic children, as opposed to amplifying what they think is best for their kids. So I think that the role of parents and the role of loved ones and caretakers and family members should always be what is in the best interest and what can we do to help our children and our loved ones and, you know, adult children as well. I don't want to erase adults. What can we do to help the loved ones, the people we love in our lives, live a happy and fulfilling and meaningful life? So that I think is the role of autistic people. I go back to my mother, and I write about it in this in my book. The moment that I got diagnosed with autism, she asked, "Well, how's he going to get into Stanford?" So, Mom, I'm sorry, I went to UNC, but I, you know.
Well, I want to read some of the comments we've gotten. Pat emailed, "In my experience, there is still a need for educating non-autistics about autism. How can someone accept an autistic person if they don't recognize the person is autistic or what that means?" Another view tweeted, "The shift is, I hope, a pivotal moment where things begin to stop being run by non-autistics who speak over us and we gain control of our own narratives and put an end to extremely traumatic practices that have been known for years to cause long-term harm. It gives me great hope." And then we got this tweet that says, "Awareness doesn't seem right because most people are already aware of autism. Acceptance doesn't seem right because we should be accepted every day of the year, not just for 1 month. I think empowerment is probably our best word. It's about us, isn't it? Not people trying to look good because they care about people with disabilities." I'm curious to hear from you, Sarah, about this nuance in this tweet about not awareness or acceptance, but about empowerment.
I have complicated feelings about the word empowerment, because I think that sometimes it's used as a substitute for systemic change. Like, I don't think the issue is that autistic people need to be empowered and feel, like, braver about speaking for ourselves. Like, that's great. But I think what's more important is things like access to education services, access to in-home care when necessary, access to competent therapists. I think a lot more about things in terms of like the systems involved than I do about individuals generally.
Where would you like to see this conversation go next as we're thinking about autistic people and how to better, I guess, accommodate their needs in our society?
I think what I'd like to see and that's happening is an increased focus on long-term care in the United States. President, and I've written about this pretty extensively, there's this program called Medicaid Home and Community-Based Services that provides people with disabilities, including people with high support needs who are autistic, support that they need to live in their own homes. So people to come and help them with things like eating or bathing or going about their normal lives. Those programs have been severely underfunded for basically as long as they've existed. And President Biden, as part of his infrastructure plan, has dedicated 1/5 of it to improving the infrastructure and the infrastructure behind care work that's necessary to help people lead good lives. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited about the policy piece of what's been developing.
Eric, your thoughts?
What I would like to see, and I'm a political reporter in my day job, you know, is seeing autistic people leading government agencies or being being the main authorities and advisors when in any in any capacity whenever autism is talked about. But to Sarah's point also, I think I would love to see an end to the payment of some minimum wage labor for autistic people and for disabled people as a whole.
That's Eric Garcia. He's a journalist, and his book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation, comes out in August. Also with us today, Sarah Luderman, an independent journalist covering disability policy, politics, and culture. And Steve Silberman, the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Sarah, Eric, Steve, thanks for being with us today. Remember, you can follow the show on Instagram, get a sense for how things work behind the scenes. Follow us at The 1A Show. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.